pressure's on.
Okay, so metabolism, you can see, is going to be especially useful for heavy iron physics. And this will be a review of work done by many people, including myself. And it's not going to be a technical talk, but rather I will try to process ideas rather than calculations. Now, so what is heavy iron physics to start with? So this is a cartoon of what I have in mind by heavy iron physics. There is an experimental program of heavy iron collisions whose goal is to study QCD at high energy density. And I want to emphasize it means high energy density, not just high energy. And the current experimental facility is relativistic heavy iron collider in Brookhaven. It started operating in the year 2000, collides both nuclei at center of mass energy, 200 GeV per nucleon. And the quest for this experimental program is to find and study corbulon plasma, which is roughly speaking the deconfined phase of QCD. And the tool to describe this is, of course, quantum field theory at finite temperature and density. But I would like to stress that it is not obvious a priori that a thermal state will be formed in this collision and this finite temperature. So theory will be relevant. Because, of course, you need many particles, many photons to thermalize. And however, there is some evidence for thermalization, which comes from lots of data and lots of non-trivial calculations, which I will not discuss. So this evidence includes particle abundances and ratios, which are reproduced by statistical models and elliptic flow, which I mentioned, which is reproduced by hydro models and jet quenching, which is an indication of short military path. So if you are an optimist, then you are saying that corbulon plasma is hidden somewhere in this collision. And this picture is, of course, is the Google Maps picture from for the Rigg collider, the aerial view of the accelerator we could look at. Now, what is ADS-CFT? So this is, again, a cartoon of what ADS-CFT is. So in its original formulation, it was a duality between a certain type of supersymmetric Young-Mills theory at a certain type of string theorem on a formulated on the background of certain 10-dimensional spacetime. And the parameters of gauge theory are related in a certain way to the parameters of string theory, namely, torque coupling of gauge theory is related to the radius of curvature of this spacetime, and number of colors in field theory is related to string coupling constant. And there is a certain dictionary that relates operators in field theory to fields in the 5-dimensional, 10-dimensional spacetime. And there is a cartoon here, which you, of course, saw many times. But what I want to stress here is that for me, ADS-CFT will be a tool either to define the field theory or to perform calculations in quantum field theory. And of course, this duality is much more powerful than N equal 4. It applies to field theories beyond N equal 4 super Young Mills. Now, this is the most important equation in this talk. So one can ask several questions. So in this collision, in this experimental program of heavy iron collisions, can ADS-CFT be useful to understand finite temperature QCD, that is, the presumably thermalized states of quark and gluons? Or one can be more bold and ask if ADS-CFT can be useful to understand the whole dynamics of the collision. So I will be on the modest side, but I will briefly mention people on the bold side and why I am skeptical about the bold part of the program. Now, there are some comments here is that N equal 4 is, of course, the simplest example, and theories which are more similar to QCD can be treated by ADS-CFT methods. And application of ADS-CFT to thermal QCD is not exhausted, and it is reasonable to ask how far this program can be pushed. So in my opinion, it is not a waste of time to do these calculations. One reason is that results are non-trivial and relatively easy to derive compared to conventional methods. And of course, if there were an effective tool to perform real-time computations in strongly coupled QCD at finite temperature and density, there would be no need to invoke ADS-CFT. However, in absence of such a tool, ADS-CFT is the best we have for some types of questions. And regardless of trick, you can say that understanding finite temperature field theory is an interesting question by itself. And ADS-CFT can be useful. example of shared viscosity that I you know, mentioned. Now, at this point, if you are a QCD person, you should be wondering why N equal 4 supergermic meals may have anything to do with thermal QCD at all. And of course, there are questions that you may ask. One question is that N equal 4 supergermic meals is obviously a supersymmetric series, but QCD is not. And the answer to that is that they're going to consider the series at final temperature, where supersymmetry is broken anyway. Another question is that N equal 4 is a conformal field series, but QCD is asymptotically free. So how is so why is N equal 4 relevant at all? And the answer to that, well, let us look at thermodynamics of QCD, which comes from lattice calculations. And this picture shows energy density in QCD divided by T to the 4 as a function of temperature over TC over the confinement transition temperature for various flavor content. And so what you can see here is that these curves here are pretty much horizontal. They do not show much temperature dependence. And this is, of course, what you expect if you have a scale invariance in your theory, because this means that temperature is the only scale. So when you model by T to the 4, these curves must be flat. And now, if you instead, if you plot not energy divided by T to the 4, but energy divided by static Boltzmann energy density, which is the energy density in free theory, then you find that you know, all these curves here above TC are very close to each other for various flavor content. And then you might ask, where is N equal 4 supergermic meals? And N equal 4 supergermic meals is here. And this number here is 0.75, which is the famous three-quarters mismatch predicted by ADS-CFT between infinite coupling and zero coupling. Now, of course, you should not be viewing this picture as a prediction of N equal 4 PCD. Most probably, it is a pure coincidence that this curve and supergermic meals follows so closely the curves of QCD. But at least the very fact that these curves here are flat, this shows that scale invariance is not inconsistent with thermal QCD. Now, if I were totally honest, I would be showing you the plots for pressure as well, for entropy, and not just energy density. And plots for entropy or pressure in QCD, they do not show such a good horizontal dependence. But above 2 or 3 TC, they're pretty much horizontal. So what I want to say is that scale invariance is not inconsistent.
Eventually, the color curves will go to 1.
Well, at infinite, yes, at infinite temperature. Yes.
So it's not an illusion that you can stay horizontal forever.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so another question is that at high temperature, QCD is weakly coupled. So why don't you use perturbation theory? And the answer is that it is true that at high temperature, QCD is weakly coupled, but it is only true at asymptotically high temperature. At weak temperatures, which is about 2 TC, QCD is strongly coupled. And, well, finally, you may ask, well, okay, so, hold it. Well, QCD is, after all, is a sensible, it is a decent theory. It has, you know, it has asymmetrics, it has, you know, bound states, it has decent Hamiltonians, it has all the you know, properties that you expect of a nice quantum field theory. But QCD, but N equal 4 supergermic meals is just a bunch of non-abelian junk flying around that doesn't do much. And the answer to that is that above the confinement temperature, QCD is also mostly a bunch of non-abelian junk flying around without doing much. So it's not that terribly different, you may hope, after you take into account the counting in degrees of freedom. So this is the lesson that I'm going to take from this, that I will be using strongly coupled N equal 4 supergermic meals as a model for QCD at temperatures above deconfinement, but not too far above deconfinement, which is the precisely range, which is precisely the correct temperature range for weak. And this is the plan for the talk. So we'll be discussing three issues that people worked on in N equal 4 and potential applications to the momentum transport, electromagnetic response, and energy loss by heavy probe. And then, if I have time, I will briefly mention thermalization, and I will conclude this potential open questions.
So excuse me?
Yeah.
I mean, the QCD phase boundary across as well for low temperatures and high densities, it's just so unfortunate that we cannot do experiments like that. Then would your conclusion still apply to that case, T equals U, mu equals infinity, so chemical potential to infinity?
Well, it would be nice to see lattice thermodynamics data for large chemical potential at small temperatures.
But it's improving, right? They have some methods to have low temperature, high temperature. I mean, of course, not the exact limit for chemical potential to infinity, but I'm just wondering, because the characteristics of QCD, of course, is not just that you have a phase position at some point, but you have a phase boundary in order of your theory to be a good model for QCD. You have to reproduce the full boundary and not only certain points on this boundary.
Oh, well, I mean, if you want a good model of QCD, you're absolutely right. But this is not going to be a good model of QCD. This is going to be a good model of certain points and phase in the phase diagram of QCD. I mean, we believe it is not a very bad model, but at least I hope it is not a very bad model. Of course, it cannot be. I mean, for goodness sake, N equals 4 superconductors like a formal series can have no phase transition at all.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So there is no chance that that it will be a good model, for example, in the vicinity of this phase transition. Of course.
Or to the right.
But or far to the right, where PCDs are symmetrically free and quickly coupled. Mm-hmm. But in this window, there is a hope. And the hope is that ADACFT is the first time that we got a handle on real-time dynamics of strongly coupled non-abelian plasmas. And even though you may say it's not exactly QCD, I mean, there is simply no other tool to study real-time dynamics of strongly coupled non-abelian plasmas. So this is the best. Now, momentum transport is governed, of course, by conservation law for energy momentum density. So here it is written in terms of energy density and momentum density, so the same equation. And if you study small deviations from small fluctuations from thermal equilibrium, you will have to express these quantities for stress tensor, basically, in terms of conserved currents, energy density, and momentum density. And you do this by writing so-called constitutive relations. So this is the fluctuation in energy density. And then you have two terms which are consistent with the symmetry of Tij. One multiplies the divergence of momentum density, and one is this symmetric combination. The coefficient in front of them are called shear bulk viscosity. So this eta here is shear viscosity, z is bulk viscosity, v squared is, of course, the speed of sound. And these viscosities are input from microscopic physics. And you should be viewing this plus this as sort of effective low energy description for small fluctuations on top of thermal equilibrium. So if you solve this plus this, and then you find that you have two eigenmodes. One is the shear mode, which is the fluctuation in transverse momentum density, which does not propagate, it simply decays here, as you see. And one is the sound mode, which is the fluctuation in longitudinal momentum density, or longitudinal velocity, if you wish, which propagates at the speed of sound, and also damps because of these viscosities. So what I want to emphasize here is that long wavelength response is controlled by a small number of kinetic coefficients, which are basically just these viscosities plus diffusion constant if you have conserved currents such as Becquerel. Now, how do you actually extract these coefficients from microscopic physics? So you have to recall that linear response tells you that these hydrodynamic modes manifest themselves as hydrodynamic singularities at small frequency in momentum and momentum in two-point functions. So for example, a two-point function of transverse momentum density will have the singularity at omega is equal to gamma times k squared, which is a reflection of the presence of this hydrodynamic shear in in terms of momentum. And by doing various manipulations, at least in other formulas, taking various limits of k goes to 0, omega goes to 0, you can derive so-called Kubo formulas, which express a shearing bulk viscosities in terms of equilibrium two-point functions of various components of stress energy tensor. And so these are these Kubo formulas. And so the lesson here is that the viscosities are extracted from small frequency limits of real-time correlation functions. And this is where ADS-CFT comes up. Because in ADS-CFT, you can evaluate these two-point correlation functions for all omega and k. And this can be done. And so I can show you some pictures here from our paper with some data. Now, what you're looking at here is finite temperature contribution to two-point function for transfer stress, this one as a function of dimensional frequency. Now, the only reason I've plotted for several values of stream momentum, especially momentum, the only reason I'm showing this picture is that is so that you can see that you can compute this Ketar-Lindgren's function or the spectral function for all omega. Now, so how do you extract shear viscosity? So shear viscosity is extracted from the zero frequency intercept here for the curve that corresponds to stream momentum equals zero. So if you do this and reinstall the numbers, then you find this value for shear viscosity. So you see it's proportional to TQ, which is basically bidimensional analysis because T is on the scale of the theory. It's proportional to N squared, which is the counting of degrees of freedom. And the only, if you wish, non-trivial information here is this coefficient, pi over 8. Now, you can also look at other components of energy momentum tensor. And again, the reason why I'm showing these plots now is so that you can see the presence of hydrodynamic modes. So let's look at this picture, for example. This peak in the spectral function is the peak that corresponds to the sound wave at small momentum. As you increase stream momentum, then you see that this peak starts to spread out more and more and eventually disappears as momentum becomes large. So this is, if you wish, a living proof for you that hydrodynamics is the right effective theory at small momentum and frequencies, because it shows, I don't want to say the word phonon, it's a well-defined quasi particle, but it shows a narrow peak in the spectral function when momentum is small, which is what you expect of your low energy degrees of freedom. And you can also look at singularities of the retarded Green's function in the complex frequency plane. And again, you find exactly what you expect from hydrodynamics. There is a hydrodynamic singularity for the transverse momentum that corresponds to the shear mode. And there are hydrodynamic singularities in the energy density that corresponds to the sound wave. Now, the difference between these fat dots here and the others is that if you take momentum to zero, then all these singularities stay at finite distance from the real axis, but these ones approach the real axis. So here's a singularity which is arbitrarily close to the real axis, which is a signature of a good quasi particle. So again, that you find that singularities, which are the quasi-normal modes in this setup, they correspond to the right hydro modes that you expect. Now, if you wish to compare strong coupling and weak coupling for these two-point functions, you can do this, and you can learn an interesting lesson. So this picture shows a cartoon for two-point function for transfer stress, which is the quantities responsible for shear viscosity. Now, this blue line here is the result in zero temperature supercoupled. This red line is the result in infinitely strongly coupled supercoupled. And this purple line here is a cartoon for weakly coupled supercoupled. Now, the value of shear viscosity is set by the intercept here. So shear viscosity is small at strong coupling, shear viscosity is large at weak coupling. So you see that as a function of real frequency, this curves look very different than small omega. Now, you may ask, so how do these Q curves look like in Euclidean time. The reason you ask for this is that lattice simulations in PCT are done in Euclidean time. So you want to convert these curves to Euclidean time. So what you find is you find something very surprising. So this is what made not so surprising, but something very interesting. So this is a picture from the team. The red curve is the infinite coupling superinfinites, and the dashed curve is the free superinfinites. So what you see here is that in Euclidean time, there is basically no difference between zero coupling and infinite coupling. Now, what does this tell you? This tells you that if you're doing lattice simulations in QCD at this temperature around 2 dC where coupling is large, so all lattice simulations are done with some errors. If you have error bars, there is basically no chance that you can differentiate between between this curve and this curve in the positive. And recent lattice simulations for shapeless positive, they call these error bars, they're huge. And so there is no chance that shapeless positive can be currently extracted from lattice simulations. So I think this is kind of one of the other reasons that you should be excited about ADS-CFT, because conventional methods in QCD fail for determining shapeless positive and strong coupling. Any questions about this? Okay, so some speculations about universality of shared exposures. I don't know if you saw this paper. So there is a cute paper by Ed Purcell, which is called Light at Low Reynolds Number, published in American Journal of Physics in 1977. So there is a paragraph here which I blew up for you. It says, if you look at the chemical rubber handbook, you will find that there is almost no liquid with viscosity much lower than that of water. Viscosities have a big range, but they stop at the same place. I don't understand. So that's a nice observation made by Ed Purcell in 1977. Now, how do we connect this to what we are doing here? We know that the ratio of viscosity to entropy, which is the dimensionless number calculated by the entropy to normalize by the degrees of freedom. You know, this ratio is large when coupling is small. And how large is it? It was recently calculated quantitatively by these people from McGill University. And we know that this ratio is equal to 1 over 4 pi when this coupling is infinite. And of course, it is natural to assume that this coupling varies from infinite coupling to small coupling. This is always larger than 1 over 4 pi. And I must say that there are also corrections to this ratio at finite but large coupling computed here by Andre and others. It turns out that this ratio 1 over 4 pi is actually universal. It was proven for a large class of field series with gravity duals, and so far there are no counterexamples. It was originally argued to be universal for theories without chemical potential. It was further generalized by Alex for theories with its finite chemical potential. So it seems that this 1 over 4 pi is something very robust. And if you look at real life substances, fluids, and liquids, gases, they tend to satisfy this bound. And furthermore, if you try to make an argument based on uncertainty principles and quasi-particles that you can read in our paper, this one, then you find that this inequality is enforced on you by basically uncertainty principles. So there is some flavor that something of this must be true, but so far it has not been proven rigorously or disproven rigorously. So I think it's interesting to think about whether there is something that is found. Now, okay, so what is the viscosity method trick? Well, okay, so if quadrillion plasmas were a liquid that you could put in a jar and then take a torsional pendulum in this jar, study its oscillations, of course you could measure the viscosity of quadrillion plasma. Well, unfortunately, Rick does not do exactly that. What it does is it measures angular distributions for particles which are emitted in this collision. And then these angular distributions are confronted with hydro models for the expanding fireball. And quantitatively, people characterize these by so-called coefficient of the elliptic flow, which is the coefficient that tells you about azimuthal anisotropy for particle distribution. And okay, so I'm showing this picture here. The only reason I'm showing it is to show that these experimental points for elliptic flow can be reproduced by various hydro calculations. And so where does viscosity come in here? So viscosity comes in as an input parameter in the hydro simulations. And to reproduce both elliptic flow and particle spectra from hydro, this ratio of viscosity to entropy must be small. Particular, several people, including Derek Kinney and Byron Tomaszki, they quote that this ratio must be less than 0.3 in order to reproduce both elliptic flow and particle spectrum. Now, in n equal 4, it is, of course, 1 over 4 pi, which is 0.48, which satisfies this requirement. Now, what happens in perturbative QCD? Now, in perturbative QCD, shear viscosity was computed by Arnold, Moore, and Yarke. And if you take their result, extrapolated to the relevant temperatures, then you find this ratio for viscosity to entropy, which is about 1.6 to 1.8. So here I'm quoting from this paper by Marcus and McLennan. So what do you see? So what you see is that n equal 4 does very well at the shear viscosity, because shear viscosity is small, consistent with this hydro simulations, but perturbative QCD predicts something else. Sorry. So if you're an optimist, then you say n equal 4. That's better.
I mean, is the extrapolation valid? I mean, legal in the sense that
no,
right? You're already
yeah,
strong coupling regime.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, no.
They use bomb states. So that's a measurement for bomb states, right? And you measure delta, lambda, and all these parameters.
Yeah.
So okay, then I can understand.
There are two stages, in hydro evolution. So one is, okay, so first you assume that you have a thermal state, which is the quadrillion plasma. Then the state expands and cools. As it cools, it hadronizes. And what you measure is, of course, you measure the hadrons and not quadrillions. Now, how much this fireball expands before it hadronizes is controlled by hydrodynamics. So it is, I'm not saying it is controlled by shear viscosity, but shear viscosity is definitely there. Now, how to implement the transition from this quadrillion plasma to the hadron phase is entirely different business. But what I'm saying is that if you're following the standard procedure, which people do in hydro simulations, there are some standard algorithms to do this, to implement the hadronization procedure. And if you're only looking at the parameters at the initial stage of the collision, namely the evolution of the quadrillion plasma fireball, then you find this that viscosity must be restricted to this point. So it is a statement about viscosity of quadrillion plasma, not about the viscosity of the only hadron in place. Okay, electromagnetic response. Now, I'd like to address the question about production of real and virtual photons from quadrillion plasma or from any other thermal state. So there is a formalism to do this. So if gamma is the number of photons emitted per unit time per unit volume, and the photon interaction has this form where electric charge is so small that photons do not thermalize, then the photon rate is basically given by the two-point function for electromagnetic currents evaluated as light-like momentum. And now if you imagine that your virtual photon can decay into electron pair, then you can find the rate for electron production, which is also given by the same two-point function, but not by the time-like momentum of the emitted pair. And so the lesson here is that the emission spectra, so basically the statement about how bright this plasma is encoded in two-point functions of electromagnetic currents. So basically what you're doing is you're evaluating this blob to leading order in electric couplings, but to all orders in QCD coupling or any other coupling of the ephemera. So, and this is exactly what ADACFT can do for you. You can evaluate the whole blob here at large photon. So we can ask the question about emission of real and virtual photons from angle four superluminous plasma. And at this point, you should be puzzled because N-equal 4 does not have a photon. It only has adjoint representation method fields, gluons, fermions, and scalars. However, it's easy to rectify. We can introduce a photon. And to do so, we gauge a U1 subgroup of SU4 R-symmetry group with some small coupling E. And now we get yourself a photon because your electromagnetic current is now the R current, which is conserved, non-anomalous, and couples to a U1 gauge. And if you're working to leading order in E, which is this coupling that I use to gauge this, this subgroup, then photon and electron rates are simply given by R current spectral functions. So even though you don't know what dual strings really corresponds to so-called modified superluminous that has a photon, you don't care, because to lead in order two-point function of electromagnetic currents is the same as two-point function R currents, and this you know how to calculate in the ADACFT. So you can evaluate the spectral function, which is imaginary part of the retarded function, and then the emission rate is simply the spectral function times the Boltzmann distribution.
Not being an expert, I'm going to ask a lot of stupid questions, but is that legal in the sense that you're making use of ADACFT, you know, the fact that you have the gravity dual, and now you're not sure, I mean, do you know that this theory has a gravity dual, and then that's...
No, I don't. But what I'm saying, even though I don't, it doesn't really matter. Because what matters is that the leading order in E, two-point function in this theory is the same as two-point function in equal four.
I see.
So the only reason I'm talking about this photon is to give it some kind of flavor of physical interpretation.
Yes, but you're still, I see, so you're calculating the two-point function of the same R current you would have had in the original N equals four.
No, so the new feature here is that now you can meaningfully reinterpret this two-point function as something that gives you the photon rate, if you were to gauge this.
I guess there are two couplings. There is a coupling of the total of plasma, which you take to be very large,
right,
and it has a dual gravity. And then there is this additional coupling, which is the electromagnetic coupling. And you can make it arbitrarily small.
So you're really thinking of only a perturbative rearrangement of what's
going on. So it's something
gravity.
Like it's an electronic decay. So you compute the correlators of the hadronic currents, but the electronic ones.
No, and in fact, this is exactly what you have, you know, in real life. Because if you're looking at QCD coupling at, you know, Rick temperature, is something order one. Now this one is 1/137. Now, so the photon rate is given by the spectral function times Bose-Einstein distribution. You can evaluate the spectral function. So what you're looking at is this plot of the spectral function divided by frequency. The only reason I'm showing it is that you can evaluate it. It has some meaningful small frequency behavior consistent with Heidel, has some large frequency behavior. What I want to emphasize is that this spectral function can be evaluated in closed form. It is simply given by this hypergeometric function, various arguments. And then emission rate is finite and independent of coupling in the limit of infinite coupling.
So these exponents like omega to 2/3, did you look at some DP ranges and see how basically the high energy tail of the spectral function changes as you change the dimensionality of the
HC? Oh, I don't know. Well,
is there some simple, I guess what I'm saying is there a simple way to say is that all of that should be 2/3?
I don't think
I mean 4 dimensions.
Well, no. This omega is omega is real omega divided by 10 dimensions.
Yeah, but that's a critical exponent 2/3. I'm asking, is there?
I'm not sure, because light-like momentum is thickier than time-like or space-like. So at large omega, this function does not approach the zero temperature result. So the time-like functions do approach the zero temperature result as you increase omega, but this one does not. So I'm not sure.
Sorry, just to continue. There was a follow-up paper by Van Archer. So in their case, did you look what's the high frequency of the spectral form? At least they claim that they do this basically in five-dimensional
experiments.
So
no idea.
You don't.
We can talk. Now, offshore photons with strong coupling. So you can, okay, so this is exactly what I was saying. Two-point functions at time-like momentum. Now, I see you are not too excited about these plots, but if you got a lattice gauge series, you should be excited because this is kind of what people are working on. There are several groups that work right now in basically computing these two-point functions of conserved currents at non-zero time-like momentum from lattice QCD. So what I want to show is that these two-point functions are basically very close to the zero temperature result here, which are these dashed lines here. And if you look at the right two-point function in the right symmetry channel, then you see, which is basically the longitudinal current divided by the frequency, then you see a picture, which again corresponds to the diffusion of individual symmetry. Electrical conductivity. So you can compute, once you know two-point functions, you can compute electrical conductivity, again, given by Kubo formula, so that zero frequency slope of a certain two-point function. This is the result that you find in infinitely strongly coupled superimpedance. In weakly coupled superimpedance, it of course shows some dependence on the coupling constant, and presumably there is some smooth extrapolation between the two. Now, if you now look at weak coupling, so in weak coupling, the photon rate in QCD was computed by Arnold and Hilfey. Now, you can do exactly the same computation, well, not exactly, but you can do a similar computation in superimpedance at weak coupling. And what you find is that there is a certain expression for a two-point function, for, I mean, the spectral function that gives you the photon rate. So it has some prefactor here, which basically tells you how many degrees of freedom you have, has some log dependence on the coupling constant, and it has some momentum dependent function here. Now, what I want to say is that this is the result in superimpedance. In QCD, it basically looks exactly the same, except this coefficient is different because you have different number of species in QCD, and this function C is different. Now, how different is this function is plotted here? So you're looking at the blank line here. Black lines. Now, what I want to say is that this function, which essentially tells you all non-trivial information about the photon rate, well, it is different in QCD and superimpedance, but it is not too deep. So you may hope that you can arrange photon rate and superimpedance close to QCD. Let's skip that. So now I want to compare weakly coupled superimpedance and strongly coupled superimpedance because I have the results of both. And this is what you're looking at. Now this black line here is the photon spectrum in infinitely strongly coupled superimpedance. This red curve here is the result in weakly coupled superimpedance evaluated at some arbitrary value of coupling constant. Now T has two parts. One part is the high momentum part that you can compute in perturbation theory. One part is the low momentum part, which you can also compute in perturbation theory. At intermediate momentum here, there are some technical difficulties. There is no computation of how this looks like at weak coupling. But presumably, that's something similar to the strongly coupled curve. Now, The physical Bessel shape is the following. At small momentum, photon emission rate is always greater in weak decoupled system because the slope here is greater. And the reason the slope here is greater is that the slope here is set by the value of electrical conductivity or diffusion constant, if you wish. And the diffusion constant is greater at weak coupling. Now, at large momentum, photon emission rate is greater in strongly coupled system. And this is because this expression here has an overhead factor over the coupling constant, weak coupling, and there is no such suppression at strong coupling. So what you see is that evolution between strong coupling and weak coupling is consistent.
So is there some sort of a sum rule that tells that the total area of the graph is independent of the coupling?
I don't know.
But there is no way to check because, you know, there is no weak coupling computations that rounds up to.
Yes. But,
isn't it true that the total emission should depend on coupling?
No, it depends on couplings. I mean, you should not be, I mean, the fact that this has this bell shape, you should not be thinking that this has anything to do with black body radiation. Because black body radiation means that your photons are totally thermalized. Now, these computations assume arbitrarily small electric coupling, which means once a photon is emitted, it just goes without any subsequent interaction. So this has nothing to do with black body radiation, even though it looks very similar.
But can I make a statement that the stronger coupled plasma is, in some sense, brighter than weakly coupled one?
Well, I mean, strongly coupled plasma is brighter if you look at you know, high frequency photons. It is less bright if you look at low frequency photons.
The statement about the integrals, right?
Yeah, the luminosity.
Yeah, so the luminosity, if you wish.
The luminosity should be larger, right?
So it's an interesting thing to look at least on the a strong coupling result. It should be it's a difficult computation, but it's more or less straightforward to see whether the total, you know, how the total luminosity changes as you move away from infinite coupling. It's just alpha prime corrections.
Yes, I agree, but I don't know any first principle argument for this symbol. Now, instead of comparing weakly coupled superintermediates and strongly coupled superintermediates, and I want to compare superintermediates and QCD, which was kind of the whole point of this program. Now, to mimic QCD, we need to choose a normalization of this electromagnetic current. And we choose to normalize it in such a way that the leading short distance behavior of this two-point function is the same as is the same in superintermediates as in QCD. So this is just a statement about what you choose for the values of your electric charges. And further, we have to choose some value for the coupling constant in superintermediates. Now, if you compare superintermediates and QCD at the same value of the coupling constant, then this is what's fine. This dashed line here is on QCD, this blue line here is, I mean, this is three flavor matrix QCD. This is superintermediates. So what you see is that photon emission rate with superintermediates is much greater than that you see. However, what I want to say now is that it is not correct to compare the two theories at the same value of the coupling constant. There is no reason you should be doing this when you want to compare two different theories. Rather, you should be comparing them at some value of some physical quantity, such as the biomass or thermal ferment. And if you compare the two theories at the same value of, say, the biomass, which means you should rescale the top coupling in a certain way, or if you compare them at the same value of thermal ferment mass, then you find that photon emission rate in superintermediates is very similar to this. Now, what is the lesson? So the lesson is that you do not want to compare, when you're making comparison between superintermediates and QCD, you do not want to compare them at the same value of top coupling. So for example, alpha s to be 0.3.5 in QCD does not correspond to this top coupling to be equal to, you know, G squared and C, which is 2 pi times 3, roughly 20. So you don't want to take 20, but what you want to take is from 2 to 5. Because, as you said, you must compare some physical quantity. And now you see that 1-over lambda corrections are probably important for better comparison of this QCD. Okay, so the electron emission making, how are we doing on time?
You have 15 minutes.
15, so I'll skip the electron emission. We'll go to energy loss by Eric Ward. There has been some activity recently, some splash of activity on this subject. So there are some recent papers that, you know, we should look at them and check out their citations first. Now, the problem that you have in mind is you take a particle of mass m, which is your probe, that moves in a strongly interacting thermal medium whose mass is much, whose temperature is much smaller than m. So think about charm or 1.3 GeV moving in this QCD plasma of 200 MeV. And there are all sorts of questions that you now want to ask. So what do you mean by energy of this probe? How localized is this probe? How do you separate energy of this probe from the energy of the medium, because the coupling is very strong? And what is the physical mechanism for energy loss and so on? And these are non-trivial questions. And you should keep in mind that perturbative language, such as Bremsstrahl or Poisson scattering that people use conventionally, so all this language is useless on coupling is strong. And the model in which we do this is N equal 4 plus fundamental matter, this number of labels much smaller than number of colors. So this is a cartoon again how this works. Now if you don't have any fundamental matter, then ideal degrees of freedom in this boundary theory, they correspond to closed strings in the bulk. Now if you want to add fundamental degrees of freedom, then you need some open strings in the bulk. And the way to do this in N equal 4 super and mean for figure out the cartoon cuts. It turns out you have to put a certain type of brain in the bulk, the G7 brain, and this quark mass is set by basically the position of this G7 brain in this extra dimension. So this configuration here corresponds to a single quark in the deconfined phase in super and means, and this string configuration now corresponds to a quark into pair. And so what you see here is that if you want to analyze energy or momentum loss over quark, you simply have to look at energy and momentum loss over a classical string that you can analyze by solving basically the number of water equations. Now, how heavy a quark can you treat this way? Now, a static string, this string, this corresponds to a quark that has this energy. So at zero temperature, you know, there is no black hole, so there is a certain value for quark at zero temperature. Now, at finite temperature, the string is shorter because you have cut it off by the position of the event horizon here. And this contribution to its energy, you interpret as thermal mass at non-zero temperature. And it happens to be proportional to square root of lambda times temperature. Now, what you see here is that if your quark is lighter, this means that this G7 brain goes down. And eventually, for light quarks, it will fall into a black hole. And if you want your quarks to be described by semi-classical strings, you don't want this. So this means you can only treat sufficiently heavy quarks this way. And so this is the condition. So the mass of the quark must be larger than roughly the thermal mass, which is not a problem. And so the lesson here is that if you wish to analyze energy loss over heavy quark, then you have to solve classical equations of motion for a moving string. So take the simplest case, infinitely massive quark. So in this case, this G7 brain is pushed to infinity. And you have to look at classical strings in this spectrum between the Eddius boundary and the black hole horizon, or black brain horizon. So a static string here is just a quartile test. So if you try boosting this string at some constant speed, then this still solves the equations of motion for you. However, the solution is problematic because minus g, which is the determinant of the induced metric on the Borel sheet, flips sign at a certain value of this coordinate u in between horizon and boundary. And so once it changes sign, then you find that energy and momentum of this configuration become complex, and the solution isn't physical, so you just hold it. Yeah.
It is true that at the technical level, what you said is true. However, on the physical level, what you are doing is very problematic because what you are boosting a classical string, and you are doing a classical computation, and so your fork is always infinitely massive because square root of lambda is infinity in your computation.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem might not be, you know, the one that you described, but maybe that's still the wrong thing to do.
Well,
trying to interpret it is really as a moving, you know, as a sort of, you know, trying to boost an infinitely massive fork, which is always what you do. Never doesn't matter where the boundary is.
No. I mean,
where's the? I mean, where's
no, the no. Boosting simply means you're looking at it in a different direction. So.
Oh, okay. But yes. But
it is the wrong thing to do. Because of the following reason, you know, the boosting variance is broken by the temperature, by the presence, I mean, from the filter point of view, there's a heat burst that says the preferred reference frame. So there's no boosting variance there. So that's how you don't expect the solution to spread. However, you can find a solution such that minus G is positive everywhere. So this solution will correspond to some non-trivial profile for the string in the fifth dimension. And you can find the profile for this function x of u. And again, so this is something that moves at constant speed. There's some source that moves at constant speed on the boundary. Now, so what does this mean? So you have a thermal system. So how can you have a particle that moves at constant speed? Surely there must be some dissipation. Because there are particles in the thermal mass flying around. Now, the way this solution is interpreted is there's an external agent here on the boundary that is pulling on this quark, which is what allows this quark to move at constant speed. Now, this means that some momentum is pumped in at the boundary here, and this momentum leaks along the string to infinity or to the horizon of the black hole, whatever you wish to think about it. But physically is that the momentum that you pump into the source to allow it to move at constant speed is the same momentum as the source would lose were it to move without any external agent. Now, you can do this quantitatively. You can just find GDT for the string, and then you find some expression that's proportional to this gamma factor and velocity, and you stick some mass here, some mass here, then you say this is your friction coefficient proportional to momentum. And this friction coefficient has a finite limit as lambda goes to infinity, because basically there is square root of lambda here, and then your mass must be heavier than square root of lambda times t.
So in one consistent, coming back to what Alex said, one consistency check of your calculation would be, I mean, if you compare to your result as a Landau-Poulorandschutz effect, that would be a typical thing to compare to. You have a heavy quark moving through a dense, colorful medium, and this decreases energy, actually, the energy loss compared to having a heavy quark moving through vacuum.
When you have a particle that moves in vacuum, it doesn't fail.
Yeah, of course, the setting there was that it needs to get rid of a gluon because they consider germanium states, actually, but I think. I could say you have two heavy quarks moving.
But it's not clear because, okay, so what is LTM effect? LTM effect is basically radiation of gluons, if you wish, at small angles, right, as this particle.
Right.
Now, there are no gluons here. right? Because the system is infinitely strongly coupled. There is nothing you can add here, right? It's just an infinitely strongly coupled soup of.
The mechanism is different, but at the end of the day, you want to compare the energy loss in both pictures.
Well, yeah.
Well, I guess there is also another way how you can sort of make sense. So what Pavel described is one way to making it finite, right? So you just, but another way, if you look at theories which in which you ask the question. So say I take a conformal theory and I deform it away from conformality, and I can benchmark it one result against the other, so I can cancel. Take a ratio of two infinite results and I can get a finite answer. So I can extract some physical quantities. How my dissipation behaves depending whether or not how I change a mass scale, how much do I deform away from conformality. So in this case the results will be finite and
do we know this condition of
It depends on what question you ask, but yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Well, you should be, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, I will be sure.
Okay, sorry.
So let's keep this. Okay. So one puzzle here that I want to mention is that, of course, I told you that P naught was proportional to P. Now, however, this is a thermal system, so there must be. If you think about this physically, there really must be some random force which acts on this source. So the right equation should be, of course, the Langevin equation, where you add this noise term to your P dot. And the coefficient here in this correlation of noise term is again proportional to the friction coefficient. And what this equation predicts for you, it predicts basically the Brownian motion of a particle. With a certain value of this diffusion coefficient, which is inversely proportional to the friction coefficient, which is the Einstein relation. Now, if you take the value for this friction coefficient, so this is what you find for the diffusion coefficient, which is also computed independently by Horn and Derek in this paper. Now, however, if you look at a static string, that the static string obviously does not experience any force. It does not, I mean, you do not see any Brownian motion when you just, because a static string simply solves a number of equations. So this is puzzling from one point of view. But from the other point of view, see that this diffusion coefficient here is inversely proportional to the square root of lambda, which you take to infinity. So I suspect that in order to see Brownian motion, we need to include quantum fluctuation of this classical string. And indeed, so this is consistent with this picture. So this is a picture from a paper by Rowan and Ray and Rock, which is talk here. I think this picture also appeared in Rock Myers' string 2006 talk, which shows you this diffusion coefficient as a function of temperature. So this point here is the transition temperature between the two phases when the G7 brain is above the horizon and when the brain falls into the black hole. So this is the high temperature phase, the low temperature phase. Now, note that supergravity predicts D equals zero in the low temperature phase. So this is because the D brain is above the horizon, and basically small fluctuations on the G7 brain do not see an effect of temperature, so D is zero here. However, from what I just told you, you know that this D is really not zero. It is the lambda goes to infinity limit for this expression. And evaluating this D from current correlate of the G7 brain has not been done yet. Now let's plug in some numbers. Alpha S 0.5, which is what people think is relevant to the T. So naively, this translates to Toft coupling equal to 19, which is again 2 pi over 3. Now this means that this D is roughly 0.9 over 2 pi T. Now, However, I just argued that we really need to take lambda smaller than that, say, 4. In this case, d is equal to 2. Now, it happens in QCD. Now, if we interpret QCD, this d was calculated by more than t. And at alpha s to be 0.5, they hold this way, 6. Now, can this number be compared to 3 data? Well, in principle, it can. So this, what this shows here is the Phoenix data from last year for so-called nuclear magnification factor for electrons coming from heavy meson decays as a function of transport. And these curves here are simulations by Derek Kinney in this Langevin model that they developed with Brian and his team. And what Derek tells me is that this value, 3 over 2 pi t, seems to feed the data best. I mean, of course, this curve does not feed the data very well, but you should not be discouraged about this because there is basically no model which fits this data. Then you might say, OK, so this is kind of optimistically, this is the value that you want to reproduce. Now, then you say, well, is this closer to this or is this closer to this? Well, just wave your hands. But at least it is encouraging that that n equal 4 last fundamental matter predicts you something which is the right order of magnitude. And as I mentioned, I suspect that you need one more number corrections. Ask it, Derek.
Because it doesn't look to be the 12 and 3. You could have a look at 6 also.
But where does lambda equals 4 come from? Why?
Well, because I said that, you don't, when you're comparing n equal 4 and QCD, you don't want to compare them at the same value of hot coupling, but at the same value of some physical parameters, such as the bimass or certain thermal fermions. Now, if you compare them, say, at the same value of the bimass, you see the hot coupling must be different than
that. Is that the bimass is the only, ideally, like several physical quantities, and see that they lead to the same value as the sort of effective coupling? Is there something else than the bimass?
Well, no, but what I can say is that if you compare, if you look at photon product, if you compare them at the same divine mass, so if you compare them at the same coupling, they're very different. If you compare them at the same divine mass, they're almost the same. Now you can look at the comparison for the heavy quark diffusion. Now this G here was also evaluated in perturbative superiorent mix. So more changes in perturbative QCD, but there is also calculation in perturbative superiorent mix by Chester and Worden. And now if you look now again at comparison of perturbative QCD by more changes and perturbative superiorent mix, then again you find that they're the same only if you compare them at the same divine mass, but not at the same coupling. And the same divine mass means Curtory scale coupling by factor 4.
But in the photo production, at least you are telling me that in a strongly.
No, these are weak coupling.
Yeah. That's always a weak. That's always going to be a weak coupling. Yeah.
Okay. So the lessons for heavy quarks is that the energy loss is not due to collisions. Well, there are no particles to collide with. Energy loss is not due to radiation of gluons, or because of no gluons to radiate. And energy loss is not due to emission of sound waves. And the reason for that is that when you look at this classical solution for this classical string, then the solution is exactly the same when the speed of the string is below the speed of sound and the speed of the string is above the speed of sound. There is no effect that something dramatic happens to energy loss as the speed of sound barrier is crossed. Now, you probably saw some pictures, some calculations by Steve Gubser and his students that showed energy profile of T-menu that they extracted by basically looking at magnetic fluctuations produced by string? Well, it's something that is puzzling, because the picture seems to suggest that there is a Markov, whereas I suspect there's no Markov, simply because this thing does not show any difference when the stereo sound layer is crossed. So I think it is still a puzzle as to what is the physics of energy, and it would be nice to have some symmetry on that. Now I'll come to my, okay, I'll skip thermalization in your time. I'll come to my conclusion, which is kind of an outline of future directions. So there are a couple of questions that can be studied further. So from the point of view of formalism, how to compute transport coefficients in the confinement fields? So far, there is not a single computation in ADCFT. And the reason for that is that there is no formalism to compute real-time correlation function at finite temperature in the confinement phase of ADS-QCD. And you can think about this physically, because in the deconfined phase, the dual description involves a black hole. And there is this nice formalism between outgoing, incoming boundary condition at the black hole horizon and theta of one's Green's function. So dissipation corresponds to energy loss into the black hole. But in the confined phase, you don't have any of that, because in the confined phase, the geometry does not have a black hole, but you still have finite temperature. And you still have all these effects of dissipation and retarded advanced Green's function and so on. So it's I think, something to think about. Now, another question is, how is hydrodynamics encoded in the bulk? What I told you about hydrodynamics is only understood on the level of singularities of correlation functions, but not on the level of Navier-Stokes equations. So linear hydro is only understood from correlation functions, but non-linear hydro is not understood at all, even though I suspect there must be a way to rewrite certain types of fluctuation in five-dimensional gravity in the form of Navier-Stokes equations. This has not been done. How to describe grounding motion from the bulk point of view? I already mentioned that. Isotropization, this is basically looking at a state which is not initially isotropic and how it relaxes to the isotropic equilibrium state. This will translate to an initial value problem in gravity. Hadronization, as a paradigm quotes, is again how to describe transition from the confined to deconfined phase. However, you should keep in mind that in ADS-QCD, the deconfinement transitions are typically strongly first order because of infinite and C, but in QCD, it's a crossover. In practice, you can do many things. If you like to do simulations, you can try superimposing spectral functions instead of QCD spectral functions in real-life simulations of photon emission, for example. Or, as Alex pointed out, you can compute finite coupling correction to photon production. And remember, I argued we need lambda from 2 to 5, not infinity. And you can also look at photons from fundamental representation meta fields and look at various Helicmark resonances, because there are lattice studies for Chernobyl. You can look at ADCT envelopes of that. You can look at energy loss by light quarks. And you can do all of the above, and it's non-zero chemical potential. If you're formally inclined to try to prove universality of the viscosity entropy ratio,
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that the bound for the viscosity to entropy ratio is something that is very well defined, unlike various entropy bounds.
No. I mean the universality of theta of the S equals 1/4 pi.
No.
You're not.
No. The bound.
Okay. So you don't mean re-proving.
No.
More or less settled.
No. I mean proving the bound.
Oh, the bound. There is nothing.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Not the equality.
Not the equality. Okay.
And can also look at hydrodynamic known anomalies from ADCFT. You can tell more about this if you're interested. But basically, there is non-trivial universal field theory predictions, which needs computations to subleading computation in 1/m in the bulk. So my conclusion is that ADCFT has already been useful for heavy ion physics, but we can still make it more useful and track this program a little bit further. Thank you. Thank you.
number of talk. Okay, so let's thank Mario again.